Thank you very much for attending. This is the last in the series of four, and I'm going to be talking about moral realism. And the general conception I'll be advocating will be one under which various norms ultimately flow from truth-conditional accounts of content. And more specifically, what I'm going to be doing is to develop a moral realist position within the general framework for considering realism that I outlined in my last book, In the Primacy of Metaphysics. And in particular, I'll be developing an account that's broadly rationalist in character. Actually, when I wrote that book, I thought of including a seventh chapter on moral rationalism. In the end, I thought it should be treated separately, simply drawing on the framework that's already in that book. But it will be very obvious to anybody who's reflected on these issues for just a few seconds that there are treatments of moral thought that are parallel to, analogous to, the treatment of arithmetical thought and thought about real numbers that's offered in the chapter on numbers in that book. And that's what I'm proposing to do today, to develop that. There's been very, very substantial and interesting discussion in the past 20 years of parallels or lack of parallels between domains of abstract objects and the domain of moral thought. Some people have held that you should be realists and objectivists about mathematics, but not about morality. That's a widely held view. I'll discuss some of those views. Other people have developed the parallel and claimed that there are quite good parallels between thought about numbers and thought about morality. And people who think they are good parallels divide into two camps. There are those who think that both kinds of discourse are fine. That's true of Tim Scanlon, for instance. There are those, like my colleague Justin Clark Doan in Columbia, who think that they are parallel, but you should be pluralists about both. Pluralists both about mathematics and about morality. The position I'm going to be developing has implications for these various stances. But I think the first task is to develop the position itself. I'm well aware these are just the first steps of identifying a region of logical space that I think it would be certainly interesting to investigate and possibly to inhabit, to take as one's home. After outlining the position, I will be considering some of the contrasts between this kind of moral rationalism and various other treatments, some of them non-objectivist treatments, some of them expressivist treatments. Okay, in the last book, In the Primacy of Metaphysics, I started out by saying that it's always a good idea to consider the relations between, for any given domain, the relation between the metaphysics of the entities in that domain and our concepts of that domain, or meanings of our sentences and expressions about entities in that domain. And when you consider the matter that way, consider that relation, there are, in principle, it certainly looks as if it seemingly appears, that there are just three kinds of position, that either the metaphysics is prior in the order of explanation to the nature of concepts and meanings in that domain, or conversely, the concepts and meanings about that domain are prior in the order of philosophical explanation to the nature of the metaphysics, nature of the entities in the domain. Or neither is prior to the other. Those seem to be sort of three exclusive and exhaustive possibilities. These are all under the supposition that there is a domain, that you should have some kind of referential treatment of this discourse. Otherwise, of course, the idea of the metaphysical domain makes no sense if there's entities for the thoughts to be about. What priority in the order of philosophical explanation means here is this. A is prior in the order of philosophical explanation to B. If A is mentioned in the nature of B, but not conversely. Okay, A is mentioned in the nature of B, but not conversely. Talking about priority in the order of philosophical explanation doesn't mean that you can somehow reduce constitutive facts to something else, or you can explain what it is for one thing to be constitutive of another in other terms. We're probably at bedrock there. It's not clear what that'd be, but priority does make sense. It certainly makes sense to ask, is it the case that A is mentioned in a account of the nature of B. So that's the way of setting up the issues, those three abstract possibilities. And some examples, it's very clear that there is some kind of priority in the order of explanation of the metaphysics. It's very difficult to say anything universally held in philosophy, but it is very, very widely held that, for example, observation and perceptual concepts of spatial magnitudes, of shapes, of temporal magnitudes and temporal order, when those are concepts that are founded in various ways in observation and perception of temporal and spatial relations, a good account of those perceptual concepts, the nature of those concepts, depends on the metaphysics of space and time. Why? Well, it's extremely plausible that a good account of what it is to see an object as square, or to hear one event as occurring before another, or to perceive something as a certain spatial or temporal magnitude, those perceptual states with those contents, their very nature depends on the relations to those states themselves. Those states, the property of being square, the property of two events being separated by a certain temporal or spatial distance, as always relative to a frame of reference, those properties enter an account of what it is to be capable of such perceptions. These matters are complex and delicate, but it's extremely plausible that you couldn't give a good account of what it is for perceptions to have spatial and temporal content without talking about, in certain canonical, fundamental, central cases, the explanation of those mental states, of those perceptions, by the spatial magnitudes, temporal magnitudes, spatial shapes themselves, explanation by mind-independent magnitudes. That's a case in which the metaphysics first account is also a causal account, but metaphysics first accounts, cases in which the metaphysics is prior in the order of explanation, are not always causal accounts, as we're seeing. The case of no priority, the case in which neither concepts and meanings on the one hand, nor the metaphysics of the domain on the other, and neither is explanatory prior to the other. Absolutely classic case of that would be the traditional account of secondary qualities that's derived from Locke and still widely held in one form or another. The idea that what it is for something to be read involves in some way or other, experiences of things as read. And prima facie, if that's what it is for something to have that property, the property of being read, that account takes you back to an experience of something as read, which prima facie at least embeds the concept of being read. That's lots of prima facies there, and seemingly is, but if that sort of account is right, and there is that kind of embedding of experience of things as read in the account of what it makes something have the property of being read, then the concept is itself involved in the account of the explanation of what it is to have the property. That's one way around, but of course it's the concept of being read that's there. So there's really a no priority case. In the development in the book, this is going to be important for the development of moral rationalism. When I was assessing which of these three options are genuine possibilities, I drew upon the general account of sense that I support, the general account of concepts and meanings when those correspond to sense, the general conception under which a concept or sense or mode of presentation is individuated by a certain kind of relation. For each concept C, whether it's a singular concept, demonstrative concept, recognitional concept, predictive concept, logical concept, for each concept, there's concept C, there's a corresponding relation, R of C. And R of C is the relation in which a thinker has to stand to an entity of whatever category in order to be thinking of it under that mode of presentation, under that concept. The relation is explanatory prior in the philosophy to the nature of the sense. That's a conception that was implemented in particular for demonstratives by Gareth Evans in a well-known paper, Understanding Demonstratives. I think it should be applied more generally, not necessarily endorsing all the theses that he included in that paper. And it's a thesis that It's both respectful of and distances oneself from the classic works of Frege. It's respectful of it because it's still acknowledging a notion of sense. It's a starting point for our investigation of the notion of sense. But it's a notion that does not treat senses as proudly isolated in the third realm, utterly divorced from thinkers and what it is to grasp a sense. On the contrary, this is an account that individuates senses in terms of thinkers' relations to them. Okay, why am I bringing this up? Well, because if that's what individuates a concept, if concepts are individuated by relations in that way, then it's very important that what relations a thinker can stand in to an entity is going to constrain the account of concepts. What relations a thinker can stand in to an entity depends on the metaphysics of that entity. And so if you're explaining concepts in terms of the relations which a thinker stands to entities when thinking of those entities under that concept, then the ontology is going to constrain the range of relations that are available. When you think of the matter that way, one of the three seeming options that I mentioned as apparently initial epistemic possibilities is not really a possibility. I do not think there's a genuine possibility of developing a meaning-first or concept-first view for a domain on which there's a genuine notion of reference. You may think that there's important domains for which we should have expressivist accounts, that reference isn't always important. But my thesis is, this is for some other occasion, but I don't think the concept-first or meaning-first view is ever a real option if you've got a substantive notion of reference, for the reason I just gave. If there's a genuine notion of reference, a genuine notion of entities referred to, concepts of those will depend on the relations in which you can stand to those entities, and those relations, the range of possible relations, will be constrained by the metaphysics of the domain. Okay. When I was developing the account for numbers in the last book, the thing that I will take as a stalking horse, for which the parallelism with morality is of interest, I think, I said that there were certain domains and certain ranges of concepts of those domains for which a certain slogan applies, a slogan that individuation precedes representation. Individuation precedes representation. The idea is that in certain cases, the individuation, if you like, the metaphysics of an entity or a property enters an account of what it is to be capable of thinking of that entity or property. The individuation, the metaphysics, is drawn upon in a good account of sense or concepts. So for extremely simple case of this, think of the individuation of natural numbers. What individuates the natural number one, let's say? What makes something the number one? That's a statement about the essence of the number in Kit Fine's sense, this nature. What makes something number one is that it meets the following condition. That for there to be one thing of a certain kind F is for there to be something that's F and nothing else that's F. Its role in numerical quantification individuates the entity itself. Similarly for zero, and similarly, of course, for the successor relation and relations on natural numbers. So on the screen, the third line, what makes something, what probably makes something, one number N, successor of a number M, is that for there to be N things that are F is for there to be something that's F and M things that are F and distinct from X. To be one more intuitively. And what it's attempting to say, and I think we should yield to the temptation, is to say that to think of a number of, think of something as the natural number one, is to have tacit knowledge of that first individuating condition. To think of something as the natural number one is to think of it as the thing such that for there to be that number of things for objf is for that first order condition that's been met, the thing you get taught in early logic classes, and similarly for grasp of the successor relation. So the idea is that there's tacit knowledge of these individuating conditions. The thinkers, when they're assessing whether there's six people in the room at the moment, for instance, draw on that tacit knowledge in assessing the number of people there are in the room. and thereby come to know arithmetical propositions, both about the empirical world and about the natural numbers themselves. And the attraction of that kind of approach is that it immediately integrates three things. It integrates the metaphysics, the theory of understanding, and the epistemology of the domain. And you give an account of the metaphysics, the kind of understanding draws on the metaphysics, kind of tacit knowledge of the individuation, and there's a corresponding epistemology. When you draw on that information, that tacit knowledge, in the right way, informing beliefs about natural numbers and applying natural numbers to the real world, when you draw in the right way, you will actually reach knowledge, because you're drawing on facts about what individuates those very natural numbers themselves. And so that's a tempting little package in the case of the natural numbers, and advocate that. So that's a domain in which individuation plausibly precedes representation. You draw upon the metaphysics in explaining grasp of the concepts of the domain. And you, if you do that properly, you get that kind of integration of the three things, the metaphysics, the theory of understanding, epistemology. So then the question arises, can we do the same thing or something analogous for the case of moral thought and moral domains? So the general idea applicable to the moral will be twofold, that there exist principles that individuate an entity or property. In this case, we might start off with a property being morally good, and then hope to go on to say to possess a moral concept, like a moral goodness, is to have some kind of grasp of these individuating principles, or some designated relation to those principles. I've tried to do this in other cases too. In the case of metaphysical necessity, I said that to grasp the concept of metaphysical necessity is to grasp certain principles that constrain the notion of necessity, and there too, we have a case of individuation preceding representation. You give an account of what it is for a proposition to be necessary in terms of its respecting all the principles of possibility, as I called them. And then the account of understanding would be tacit knowledge of those principles, and the proposal is here that we might aim to do the same for the case of moral properties. Just as in the case of necessity and in the case of natural numbers, this is not a causal or a perceptual model of such knowledge. Individuation precedes representation cases are not cases where we need or indeed even could have causal or perceptual interaction with the domain of entities. Nevertheless, they're still metaphysics first accounts. They're still metaphysics first accounts, because the principles of individuation give the metaphysics, give the nature of the object, give the nature of necessity in this case. Okay, so I'll be very sketchy at this point, because the details don't matter. What matters is the general structural features of the position. What might the metaphysics of the property of moral goodness of an action be? That's, of course, a substantive issue in moral thought, but the principles individuating that property should certainly include one stating that actions that promote well-being, that benefit conscious subjects, are prima facie morally good, and benefit or well-being here would need to include not just absence of suffering, but opportunities for close personal relations, development, lots of things of value. It's plausible, I think, there's an absolutely orthogonal question. You'd need a theory of value as well as a theory of morality. But let's suppose that you could get something along those lines going, and it's the sort of position that moral philosophers have developed. On the model of individuation precedes representation, grasp of moral concepts then would involve some form of tacit knowledge of these conditions for an action or institution or some character being morally good. The grasp of the principles that individuate the property itself may be highly incomplete. It may be accessed in the first instance through various affective states. It might be accessed through the emotions, and that's an important avenue for reconciling the role of emotions in moral theory with the rationalist account. And indeed, of course, it may often be epistemically an open question whether promoting something really is to the benefit of subjects. And even some conditions, even even the very fact that in the case of understanding here, we're saying you've got tacit knowledge of these principles, that gives you two resources for answering what Peter Railton and his Michigan colleagues call the car crash of an argument, the open question argument that the property of goodness could never be defined because it's always an open question for any property, whether that property is goodness. It's not a good argument. It's understandable that they should describe it as a car crash of an argument. Under this moral rationalist approach, there's two respects in which it's always an open question. First of all, it really is an open question what benefits conscious subjects and what doesn't. It's a deep and important question. But also, even if that's settled, the very fact that we're concerned here with tacit knowledge it means that for somebody who possesses the concept and the possession of the concept consists in tacit knowledge, it's always an open question whether something really articulates correctly your tacit knowledge or not. To give you a correct definition of chair that you've mastered, it can be an open question for you whether that's the correct definition. It doesn't follow because it's an open question that it's not the correct definition. It certainly could be. Okay, why do I call that a rationalist option, that very briefly described position there? Well, for three reasons. First of all, it holds that grasp and corresponding knowledge of moral properties is founded in the understanding. It's founded in grasp of the concepts. That is a classic rationalist Leibnizian claim, absolutely at the heart of Leibniz's disagreement with empiricists. Secondly, and I'll talk more about this later on, it explains how knowledge of basic moral principles, when grounded in tacit knowledge of what individuates a moral property, can be a priori. Just as the account of arithmetic would generate an explanation of how it is that your knowledge of arithmetic is a priori, the same would apply in the moral case. You have tacit knowledge of the principles that individuate the properties and entities of the domain. And it's rationalist finally, of course, because this does not require causal interaction with moral properties, just as the principles of possibility account doesn't require causal interaction with truths about necessity, and the account of arithmetic doesn't require causal interaction with the world of natural numbers. Okay, so that's the beginnings. I mean, it's looking at some distance. That's sort of a fix on a region of logical space, a kind of moral rationalism we might think of investigating further. I want to now discuss issues about genealogy and issues about the competitors of moral rationalism. So genealogy has been a lively issue for centuries and exceptionally lively issue the last 50 years. Here's a very well-known passage from Gil Harman, his 1977 book. He discusses your immediate judgment when you see some hooligans set a cat on fire, upsetting example. He says this, there's no obvious reason to assume anything about moral facts, such as that it's really wrong to set the cat on the fire. Indeed, an assumption about moral facts would seem to be totally irrelevant to the explanation of your making the judgment you make. It would seem that all we need assume is that you have certain more or less well-articulated moral principles that are reflected in the judgments you make based on your moral sensibility. It seems to be completely irrelevant to our explanation of whether your intuitive immediate judgment is true or false. It's in the quote, and there's some more recent quotes. Here's two from Richard Joyce's book on the evolution of morality. Joyce writes, whenever we judge something morally wrong, there's a complete explanation of the judgment that neither presupposes moral facts nor acts as a reductive base of moral facts. And finally, a quote from Joyce, I contend that on no epistemological theory worth its salt should the justificatory status of a belief remain unaffected by the discovery of an empirically supported theory that provides a complete explanation of why we have that belief while nowhere presupposing its truth. Okay, and these statements on first reading may seem obviously true. I think they certainly seemed obviously true to Gil Harman. And I should say immediately that Harman was actually talking about the difference between the role of observation in theory confirmation and contrasting that with how we arrive at moral judgments. And of course, I'm not saying that we observe or perceive moral facts. But the Harman quote there goes beyond that. He isn't saying just that we don't perceive moral truths to hold. he's saying that the moral facts, moral truths, are explanatorily irrelevant, more general claim, to your making a moral judgment. That's a different claim from the claim about observationality. So is that claim true? Well, it's worth substituting, I think, an arithmetical example in the quotation from Harman and assessing the result. So one such substitution we might make for the belief that it's wrong to set the cat on fire is the belief achieved by counting that the sum of the 5 boys in the room and 7 girls in the room is 12 children in total. So making that substitution, we get this. There's no obvious reason to assume anything about arithmetical facts, such as that it's really the case that the sum of 5 boys and 7 girls is 12 children in total. Indeed, an assumption about arithmetical facts would seem to be totally irrelevant to the explanation of your making the judgment you make. It would seem that all we need assume is that you have certain more or less well-articulated counting procedures that are reflected in the judgments you make. It seems to be completely irrelevant to our explanation whether your arithmetical judgment is true or false. Well, that sounds much less obvious, and I suggest it's not true. In counting up 7 steps from 5 to reach the answer that there are 12 children, 12 boys or girls, the more or less well-articulated counting procedures or principles you're using in reaching your judgment are procedures that respect what makes one number a successor of another. And that 5 plus 7 is 12 is a consequence of what makes one number a successor of another, together with a recursive definition of addition. That seems to be part of the explanation. It's only because your judgment is true, its truth being a consequence of the nature of the successor operation and the definition of addition, that you reach that judgment. Or to be more precise, what makes the content of the judgment true are the facts on which you relied in reaching it. I think what we need is an elucidation of the because in the statement that it's only because your judgment is true that you reached that judgment. So let's try if we can do something about this. What we have here is not pure causal dependency of your belief on facts about the domain of numbers, but an interesting kind of constitutive dependency of your grasp of arithmetic on the facts about the natural numbers, where that grasp actually enters the explanation of your judgment. These constitutive facts include such constitutive facts as those discussed above, such as that what makes one number n the successor of a number of m is what we talked about before. To grasp the successor relation is to have tacit knowledge that it is the relation so described. Similarly for thinking of something as addition, and similarly for thinking of something as 1 or 5 or 7, as per the treatment of numbers. So we should sharply distinguish between causal dependency of a belief on facts about that domain, the facts about the domain causally explaining your belief, which is something that is plausibly the case in genuine perception of states of affairs, distinguish that from constitutive dependency on facts about a domain, a constitutive dependency exhibited in possession of concepts and grasp of procedures in thinking about the domain, where this possession and grasp themselves are partially causally explanatory of judgments about the domain. I think the distinction between pure causal dependency and constitutive dependency is one that rationalists need to invoke across the board when considering domains amenable to a rationalist treatment. And just as a side remark, something for further research, the constitutive is also entering in the perceptual case too, actually, because there's some reliance on the constitutive connection between perceptions of things as square and judgments of things as square. The structural parallels here are interesting in complex ways. In the moral case, while Harman is surely right to say that we make an immediate intuitive judgment that it's wrong to set the cat on fire, that judgment is nevertheless made for reasons. One of the reasons is that the fire causes unnecessary suffering, and unnecessary suffering harms its subject, which is a wrong. Knowledge of that reason is founded in appreciation of the nature of the property of wrongness. It's involved in the ability to think of the property of wrongness as such. So the moral case falls under case 2 on the screen. The thinker's ability to judge immediately on such grounds that the action is wrong involves a constitutive dependency on facts about one way something can be wrong. I'd say that similar points apply to Joyce's elaboration of the Harman-style position. Contrary to that first quotation from Joyce, this one here, contrary to that first quotation, there is a respect in which the full explanation of a thinker's moral judgment full explanation does presuppose moral facts, here understood as moral truths. I'm not distinguishing here between facts and something being true. Certain moral truths are involved in an account of what it is for the thinker to possess moral concepts. Tacit partial knowledge of the truth of morality is involved in possession of a particular moral concept. Application of moral concepts draws on tacit knowledge of these truths. The involvement of moral truths is not by way of causal explanation of the thinker's moral beliefs, by the truth of those moral beliefs. It's rather a constitutive involvement of the truths in what it is to possess the moral concepts, because this is a case of individuation preceding representation, and correspondingly of what it is to grasp certain conditions as reasons for applying those concepts, which grasp in turn contributes to the causal explanation of the thinker's moral judgments. Okay, so that's an outline of where this position I want to identify in logical space stands in relation to these genealogical, highly influential arguments. Let me now turn to the question of where this position stands in relation to two other great alternatives, very carefully, interestingly investigated in the literature. The no priority position, which I said was always an option to be considered in the abstract, and the entirely non-referential expressive option. Let me take the secondary quality case first. So the no priority positions are inspired by the secondary quality analogies, and the idea in general of these positions is that part of what's involved in, for instance, a person's having a morally good character is that that character elicits admiration, or at least merits admiration. And that's said to have certain parallels with the fact that to be read involves perceptions as of readiness. So on these views, similarly, what it is to have certain moral properties involves eliciting with merit certain mental states, moral admiration or positive or negative moral emotions. So those have to be no priority views in the framework of the primacy of metaphysics, since the mental states involved in the metaphysics of what it is to have the property involve conceptualization, prima facie, of that very property. So these are distinctively mind-dependent accounts of moral properties in ways in which the metaphysics first, the rationalist option, is not. McDowell and Wiggins both fall squarely within this no priority category despite their differences. And I want to identify three problems for this secondary quality inspired position, or group of positions. Problems that it seems to me do not arise for the rationalist moral realist. So the first problem that arises is the answerability to the holding of what I call reaction independent conditions. This is a fundamental challenge, I think, for secondary quality inspired accounts. These accounts mention some emotion or sentiment that an action or personal character or institution is F in their no priority accounts of what it is to be F. But I think the rationality, indeed the morality, of acting in accordance with such emotions or sentiments is always answerable to independent reasons, that is, independent of the accounts of the emotion or sentiment, for thinking that the action or the institution or the character really is F. For example, take a feeling of guilt about some action you've performed in the past. If there's no good reason for feeling guilt about it, no independent property of the action that was wrong, in virtue of which guilt would be appropriate, then that emotion of guilt is not something that should guide action. Indeed, the emotion itself is then inappropriate. If the representation or content of the moral emotion or sentiment, its representation that something is good or bad in a certain respect, can't be justified, it shouldn't be mentioned in the account of what it is to have the moral property in question. And indeed, I don't think in those circumstances it properly justifies a moral judgment at all. Of course, you can feel guilt without yet having properly identified why guilt is appropriate. The requirement for appropriate guilt that an independent wrong-making condition is one that condition should exist, not necessarily that you should know what it is. And indeed, sometimes the emotions are in advance of our thought on these matters, an important psychological point of moral psychology. Well, the requirement that there exists some independent a reason for saying that the action is wrong when you feel the emotion of guilt, that's acknowledged in McDowell's writings when he says that a sentiment of admiration may exist but it has to be conceived as something that merits merits it, and the same would go for guilt. And there, of course, we have, obviously, as many people say, the major disanalogy with colour. Colour experience just happens to one. There's no further commitments beyond other possible experiences and their causes in endorsing the experience. But there's no such thing as a further condition that merits colour experience. The idea of something meriting colour experience does not make any sense, because colour experience just occurs to you. It's not some state you're in for a reason. By contrast, one should endorse in judgment the content of a moral emotion that something is F, only if it's reasonable to think that there are emotion-independent reasons for judging it to be F. And the same applies to the general notion of something striking one as good or as right. That's precisely what moral rationalism of the sort I've been outlining would predict to be the case. Now, in his writings on this, John McDowell moves to finesse this difference from the classical secondary quality case, of which, of course, he's well aware, by considering the property of what he calls fearfulness. And certainly it does make sense to say that something merits fear, and I agree with that. McDowell says of fearfulness that it, quote, shares the crucial feature, unquote, with the moral cases. I disagree, and I think that's a false analogy. Fear, like other emotions, does have representational content. It represents some situation or state of affairs as dangerous. But the crucial respect of disanalogy is being dangerous is a condition that's specifiable quite independently of the emotion of fear. For a situation to be dangerous is to be one that risks causing harm. That doesn't mention fear at all. Since meriting fear is thus independently specifiable as being dangerous, the case of fear is not a no priority case. So when McDowell writes, for an object to merit fear just is for it to be fearful, I disagree. Rather, for an object to merit fear is just for it to be dangerous, which is a fear-independent condition. Note also that in other genuinely mind-dependent cases, it makes no sense to say that the reaction is merited or not. Some things are indeed not appropriately laughed at or found amusing, such as attempted jokes that presume racism or the acceptance of cruelty. But when the subject matter is not too serious for amusement, there's no question of meriting amusement. There's no failure to appreciate what's merited if one doesn't find something funny that others do. And the same applies to the pleasures of taste and smell. So that's the first problem, the answerability to the holding of reaction-independent conditions. The second concerns mind-dependent status, another issue that's been much discussed. The no-priority view really is a mind-dependent option, despite the denials of some of its advocates. The mind dependence is present because the what makes claim is crucial here. What makes something right or wrong on the secondary quality view is a matter of which mental states, even if justified mental states, it produces in certain specified circumstances. And it doesn't suffice to reply to this, to appeal, as many writers do, to modal rigidification, sticking in an actual operator. That is to reply that we can fix on what mind-independent property actually produces the mental reaction, and then insist the existence of this mind-independent property frees the secondary quality-inspired account from the charge of mind dependence. Both Wiggins and Blackburn, despite other differences in their accounts, make this rigidification move, but I don't think it's good. In fact, even in the case of secondary qualities themselves, shows the inadequacy of this rigidification move as a defense against the charge of mind dependence. The concept red is rigid in respect to the physical property it picks out, plausibly some kind of reflectance property, at least for surface color. It's true, even if humans had had very different perceptual systems, perhaps with spectrum inversion, the same objects as are red would still be red. The colors of things are not changed by which perceptual systems we have. Fine. That point hardly shows that colour is not mind-dependent, because the constitutive condition on being red, the what-makes condition, still mentions experiences as of red. And to repeat what's been said over many decades now, the constitutive is not to be explained in terms of the modal. That's just another example of the point. David Lewis says in passing in a footnote somewhere, I think it's in the new work for Theory of Universals, that sticking in actual operators does not relieve the discomfort of the mind-dependent character of these, and I agree for that reason. The third reason I'd be concerned about the secondary quality inspired accounts of morality concerns a priori status. In the case of metaphysical modality, it's widely accepted that any true proposition about metaphysical necessity is either both a priori and necessary, or if it's empirical, it's a consequence of two propositions, one of which is a priori necessary, and the other is both non-modal and empirical. What's ruled out is anything being fundamentally a posteriori and necessary. So, for example, identity of the general principle that identity is a necessary relation when it holds between two things, that's an a priori principle. The proposition necessarily Hesperus is phosphorus, that is an empirical proposition, but it's a consequence of two propositions, the necessity of identity, which is an a priori matter, and the entirely non-modal empirical proposition, Hesperus is phosphorus. And the same datum seems to hold in the moral case too. It's a priori and necessary that it's good to do what reduces suffering, other things equal, and it's normally empirical matter what in fact reduces suffering. And Kant, I think, a great rationalist about morality, was well aware of that distinction. And the partition in the modal case is naturally explained by the fundamental principles that individuate necessity being a priori. The fundamental principles of possibility constrain possibility of themselves a priori. And a similar explanation, I think, plausibly applies on the rationalist metaphysics first treatment of morality. It's a priori that what promotes well-being is morally good, and so forth. It's empirical what those things are in many ways. Okay. Well, on no priority views, the views of McDowell and Wiggins, it might be said, look, Chris, you just need here to invoke a notion you yourself have used in other writings, notions I used in The Realm of Reason, the notion of the relative a priori. I said that we often needed in epistemology to use the notion not of the absolute a priori, but something being a priori relative to certain other states. So it's a priori, it's relatively a priori, that given that somebody has an experience of something as read in the right kind of circumstances, then the thing is read. And the notion of the relative a priori is, I think, a notion in good standing, probably needs more work, but certainly a legitimate resource. And somebody may say, look, it's a priori given a certain mind-dependent reaction mentioned in the a priori account, no priority account. If it obtains, then the action is good. Which states of affairs produce that mind-dependent state will not be a priori, but that's okay. I don't think this is an adequate answer. Moral principles aren't just relatively a priori. They are outright a priori, just like the principles of arithmetic and the fundamental principles of necessity are. And that's an objection to no priority accounts, and it's in favor of metaphysics first treatments of morality. I don't think that any particular experience, emotion, or sentiment is justificationally crucial to our appreciation of absolutely fundamental moral principles, such as that like cases should be treated alike, that conscious subjects are of equal value, and so forth. Anyway, those are three respects in which the moral rationalism that I'm advocating differs from the secondary quality inspired view. Let me talk about something that's long overdue in this talk, a consideration of expressivist views. These have been well developed not only by Blackburn, but especially in the very, very careful writings of Alan Gibbard. I want to focus on three problems for expressivism. They're not really specific to particular formulations of expressivism. I think they're rather inherent in the very nature of an expressivist position. The first one, which I won't elaborate on great details, in fact I've already touched on it, is the weakness of the critique of what expressivists tend to call Platonism. I don't mind the label Platonism myself. I think expressivists often tend to overlook apparently reasonable developments of a rationalist position. On the rationalist, the kind of moderate rationalist position that I'm advocating, knowledge of mind-independent arithmetical and modal truths comes from tacit grasp of the principles that individuate those arithmetical entities and properties, and the principles that individuate modal properties, modal operators. And arithmetical and modal truths are indeed mind-independent under this broadly rationalist metaphysics-first approach to these domains. But knowledge of these mind-independent domains does not need to invoke any kind of faculty, often said to be analogous to sense perception. You get such a critique in Alan Gibbard, you get it in the older writings of John Mackey, even in the more recent writings of my colleague Philip Kitcher. They say again and again that the rationalist accounts of this subject matter must invoke obscure, unclear faculties, must involve puzzling relations to some Platonistic realm. I don't think any such relations have been invoked or required in the moderate rationalism I've been describing about arithmetic, about necessity, about moral principles. I think appreciation and knowledge in these areas consists in judgment in accordance with understanding conditions related to the individuation of the respective subject matters, in accordance with individuation precedes representation. So I want to be able to steer, if I can, a middle course between expressivism on the one hand and obscure faculties on the other. And I think we can do that for arithmetic, for necessity, and for morality. That's a very general remark. A second problem for expressivist position, which I think hasn't really adequately addressed in the literature, is really loss of specifically moral content. Special case of what Wittgenstein would say, loss of problems, the accusation he made against Russell. So suppose an expressivist were to offer the following theory. To say that a type of action is morally permitted is to express acceptance of a set of norms for moral judgment that permit actions of that type. Say a type of action is morally permitted is just to express acceptance of a set of norms for moral judgment that permits actions of that type. That would clearly be circular as an account of grasp of moral concepts, because it uses the notion of a norm for moral judgment. You can't embed that in your account of what it is to be capable of moral thought if you're a thoroughgoing expressivist. It presupposes, in the absence of further elucidation, the capacity of the thinker to have norms for moral judgments. Well, could you just then cross out the moral bit and say, well, it's just an expression of acceptance of a set of norms for what to do. But that just seems to have lost contact with morality altogether. The worst psychopath has norms about what to do, but they're not norms for moral judgment. And any moral realist will say that this gap in the account of grasp of moral concepts is to be filled with an account of the thinker's relation to the property of being morally good. The relation specified in the account of grasp of the property in the possession condition or understanding condition for the concept morally good or morally permitted. But that's, of course, not a resource available to the expressivist because it involves one form or another there being genuine moral property. So this problem for the expressivist can be described as loss of specifically moral content, and I think it arises equally for Simon Blackburn's quasi-realism, which uses the notion of valuing as fundamental. Simon Blackburn says that valuing for him is essentially just a functional notion founded in features of the explanation of an agent's actions. It's sort of conceived on the model, not precisely the same, but conceived on the model of revealed preference in classical economics. So that means that valuing for Simon Blackburn has no constitutive or necessary connection with the valuable or the good. It's a functional notion that indeed also gets a grip in application to what the psychopath is said to value. Third problem that seems to me intrinsic to the character of any position that's expressivist is the apparent acceptance independence of morality. Moral norms seem to hold independently of anyone's accepting them. And that's prima facie a challenge for expressivist views under which, to say some norm tains, is to express acceptance of it. The same point applies to rationality. Norms for rationality seem to hold independently of anyone's expressing them. And as Alan Gibbard writes, anyone who takes a norm to constitute a requirement of rationality takes that norm to apply independently of his own accepting it. And I agree. Well, so Alan Gibbard's aware of the problem. What does he say about it? He says, well, it's irrational for a person to starve to death for the sake of a trim figure, even if that person genuinely prefers it. And then Gibbard goes on to write, and I quote him, this is from The Wise Choices Norms book, the norms we accept prohibit starving for a trim figure, regardless of what one prefers or what norms one accepts. And I agree again. And Alan Gibbard offers that point as his account of something's being valid independently of our own acceptance of it. Well, does that solution work? And can we apply it to moral norms too? I think this proposal doesn't meet the need. We should sharply distinguish between issues of content and issues of status. Do I have a, ooh, I don't have a thing on that. So the issue of what the norms imply or allow, indeed some things are prohibited regardless of the agent's attitudes, the norms of preferences, that's an issue of the content of the norms. We should distinguish between that and the issue whether the correctness of the utterance or judgment that something is good or rational is acceptance dependent, dependent on acceptance of something or other, not necessarily a very claim. That's an issue about the status of the norm, not about its content. I agree with Gibbard on the first issue about the content of the norms, but it's the second issue about the status that concerns those worried about acceptance dependence. The content of the norms is one thing, their source, the explanation of what it is for them to hold, is another. Compare someone who has an expressivist theory of modality, and as indeed Simon Blackburn did in one of his early papers, to say something is possible is to say it's consistent with the norms for necessity one actually accepts. That involves the circularity mentioned above, but that's not the concern right now. Indeed, the norms for necessity we actually accept do imply that something modal could be true without our believing the modal proposition. But would that justify the characterization of that account of modality as acceptance independent? Not at all. That defense speaks only to the content and not to what's involved in the appropriate holding of modal propositions in the first place. So it seems that the expressivist can't really explain the relevant kind of attitude independence. Of course, if we put the full content of the expressivist condition for someone's accepting that some action type is good, say condition E, then there will be some content involving it, which the content status distinction I drew would be inapplicable. The expressivist can fairly reject the claim, some things are prohibited regardless of whether condition E holds, because condition E is precisely what he says is involved in these moral matters. But that fuller, first of all, that fuller philosophically substantive condition E was not the one mentioned in the example of starving for a trim figure. But second and more important, it still wouldn't vindicate acceptance independence. More generally, if we stand back from this, these disputes, I think we should consider the contrast with something we indisputably think is attitude dependent, the case of etiquette originally raised by Philippa Foote. We have no difficulty with endorsing the idea that if we had accepted an etiquette under which knives and forks are to be set out on a table so that you use them in the order inside to outside, I hope the same is true in front, then that would have been the right way to set them out. But the source of the etiquette, the what makes condition for etiquette, is our attitudes, even if it's entirely true that what etiquette requires holds independently of what any particular person accepts. Let me just mention, but without developing it any further, the bearing of what I've been saying so far and the possibility of this region of logical space that I think we should explore further as a genuine option, the rationalist metaphysics first, moral realism. First of all, it bears on some of the issues about reasons independence, reasons autonomy, that came up last week in connection with Scanlon. Reasons, good reasons for making a moral judgment on the view that I'm advocating are completely dependent on what it is for the moral judgment to be true and can be explained in terms of that. So this will be another kind of counterexample to these doctrines about the autonomy of reasons, the inexplicability of irreducibility of reasons to anything else. Even in the moral case, let alone the epistemic case. And indeed, this suggests the much more general conjecture that reasons in the case of outright judgment are always explicable and answerable to fundamental features of truth conditions. That would certainly be a position that would be instantiated for these two domains I've been discussing this week and last week. That's right. Secondly, let me make a brief remark about pluralism. In his book, Morality and Mathematics, my colleague Justin Clark Doan, says that the case of mathematics and morality should be treated in parallel, but we should be pluralists about both cases, just as there's multiple geometries, there's multiple moralities, we should relax about that and not also treat it as some kind of problem or challenge to our pre-theoretical conceptions. As David Lewis would say, I would distinguish very radically between cases where pluralism has some plausibility and cases where it doesn't. I do not think there's any plausible kind of pluralism about ordinary arithmetic, just ordinary arithmetic about the natural numbers. One of the things that has sometimes motivated people to be some kind of pluralist about it is a position under which the ontology of abstract objects is set floating free, independent of the application of natural numbers. So if you look at Justin Clark Down's book, he says, well, of course, there's genuine possibilities in which the number 16 doesn't follow the number 15, even though all the truths about numerical quantification in actual and possible worlds are held fixed. I think that's wrong. I think that violates the constraint that a natural number is individuated by the condition of being the number of f's. It's impossible for something to be the number 15 without it being the number such that for there to be 15 f's is for there to be x1 to x15 things that are f and nothing else being f. I think also that this idea that if you're some kind of realist, these values can float free of application. It features also at certain points in Sharon Street's critique of what you would call Platonist or realistic views of ethics. I think it's important that we really fully appreciate the consequences of saying that an abstract object or a moral property is individuated by these relations specified in the relevant theory, individuated by the numerical quantification connections in the case of natural numbers, individuated by connections with benefit and the rest in the case of a plausible moral theory. When we do that, then I think the impression of a threatening pluralism really, or interesting pluralism, really evaporates. I do agree that prima facie certain kind of pluralism about set theory is plausible and valid. And in those cases, though there are certainly connections between the application of the notion of set and non-set theoretic vocabulary, for example, to say that something in the set of men, say it's a man, and so forth. Nonetheless, there are features of sets that on which set theories can diverge, and it's not at all clear that there are, really has to be a fact of the matter, which is the correct set theory. In my view, that fact is the analog of the fact that for certain domains, it's appropriate to take something like a Carnapian attitude that certain principles hold for the domain, and the ontology can be taken as fixed by those principles. And if there are competing set theories, they're different sets, different things satisfy these two kinds of theories. But I don't think there's anything like that as plausible for core basic things having to do with moral goodness, moral evil, moral rightness, moral wrongness, what's obligatory, what isn't. What I do think is true is that what's long been recognized in moral philosophy, that people can vary on their ideals about how sociable they should be. They vary in all sorts of ways in their values, which I think we don't necessarily want to say is a matter of moral disagreement. And I think that kind of pluralism is real, to be welcomed, and genuine. But it no more casts doubt on the core objectivity of moral principles than the availability of exotic set theory casts doubt on the validity and truth of core principles of arithmetic. I think in both cases, equally secure. So what I've tried to do here is to say that we should think further about the right way of developing the parallels between these other abstract domains, arithmetic, modality, and the moral case. And I think that if we do that, we end up with a position that's well worth assessing and respects various classical constraints on the idea of a rationalist approach to these subject matters. Okay, I'll stop this lecture on the topics. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm very pleased to be having been lectured in this great institution, and indeed to be speaking in this fabulous, wonderful city. Thank you very much.